Hi, I'm the Dark Tangent, and you're about to listen to some speeches from DEFCON 2, held at the Sahara Hotel and Casino in Las Vegas, Nevada, 1994, July 22nd to the 24th. This speech and all speeches are copywritten, the Dark Tangent and DEFCON Communications, all rights reserved, except permission is granted for educational nonprofit use. Now, the Sahara, like most other hotels DEFCON's been at, has since been blown up to make way for a bigger and better hotel. So with that in mind, sit back, relax, get ready for some good speeches.
The camera over here asked me if I was a hacker, and I said, no, I'm a cryptographer. He said, close enough. That reminds me of the scene in the Blues Brothers where they knock on the door and she says, are you police officers? No, ma'am, we're musicians. Okay. Usually I have to start my talk by saying what I do and what this software is about and what this politics are about, but I feel that there's a good chance that most of you already know. On the other hand, there is some press here, so I guess I'll have to make some introductory remarks. About 3 years ago, I wrote some software that encrypts electronic mail. This software was published for free on the internet. It's called Pretty Good Privacy, or PGP, and it uses public key cryptography to let you encrypt email to people that you've never met without the prior exchange of keys over secure channels. since that time, it has spread all around the world and has become a worldwide de facto standard for the encryption of email. It's free software, and free software has a way of spreading like commercial software does not. So it's hard to control where it goes. I want to talk a little bit about the history of how we got to where we are. Before electronics and telephones, people used to have private conversations whenever they want. There was no need for any constitutional protection for private conversations. The founding fathers, a couple hundred years ago, saw no need to codify in the Constitution an explicit right to have a private conversation, because no one at that time thought it was necessary to do. All you had to do to have a private conversation was go have one. You'd go just talk behind the barn. Nobody would be listening. If they were, you could tell, and then you could move away from them. Today, most of our private conversations are over copper or glass fiber. And so it's not clear that our private conversations are truly private. If we were to try to have a constitutional convention or simply a constitutional amendment today, I'd like to create one that says that we have the right to privacy even over electronic channels, but it doesn't change from the way it was before there was electronic communication. Most of the people that we know today, that we talk to today, we talk to electronically. I've met several people here that have told me that that they're meeting friends here for the first time that they had ever seen them face to face, that they talk to them over the internet frequently, but this was the first face-to-face meeting. I'm sure most of you have friends, but you've never seen their faces. More of our society is moving into electronic channels. Our electronic channels carry commerce, our financial transactions, personal communications, business communications. Our most intimate communications, personal and business, are carried over telecommunication networks. If we're going to preserve the privacy that we had when we used to carry on those intimate communications face-to-face, the only way we can do that is with cryptography. With paper mail, you can put your mail in envelopes. Most people do not send their mail on postcards, and so people can't read your mail. And if the government wanted to read your paper mail, with or without the envelopes, they would have to hire half the people, half the population of the country, to open the other half's mail. It would not be cost effective. So our paper mail is relatively safe. But our electronic mail is not. It is possible for government computers to automatically scan for keywords in our electronic mail. It's possible, and I'm not saying that our government actually does this right now, but it is possible for government computers or anyone's computers to scan all of the electronic mail in the country and search for subversive keywords. And then if it finds enough of the right kinds of patterns, flag it for a human to inspect. This has, I think, a bad effect on democracy. Before, if the government wanted to investigate someone, they could open their mail. It's like going fishing with a hook and a line, one fish at a time. With electronic mail, it's possible to go drift net fishing. And that makes a difference to democracy. That's like 1984. Well, the problem with cryptography has always been, how do you get the keys distributed? We can't use cryptography to solve this problem unless we could solve that problem of key distribution. In the late 1970s, public key cryptography was invented. And now for the first time, it was possible to communicate with people without first sending them a secret key that over a secure channel. If you could send them a secret key over a secure channel, then you might as well just talk to them over the secure channel. You don't need to use any cryptography at all. That's been the problem with cryptography since the days of Julius Caesar. Well, with public key cryptography, it's possible to communicate without the use of secure channels for distributing keys. If you combine that with personal computers and modems and the ubiquitous trappings of the information age, you have a powerful combination for restoring privacy. That's what PGP does. And it's being used the world over by human rights organizations. I got some mail from somebody in Burma who said that actually they were in Bangkok in Thailand. They were in touch with political opposition groups in Burma. I don't know if all y'all realize this, Burma has a really horrible government. They torture and kill thousands of people. They're a pariah among governments today. And there are political opposition groups working in Burma, and they're using PGP. They're being trained to use it in jungle training camps on portable computers. They take this knowledge to other jungle training camps and spread the knowledge there. As I understand, it's helped morale quite a bit. Before PGP came along, captured documents led directly to the arrest and torture of entire families and executions of the entire families. So it's making a difference in Burma. It's being used in Central America. I talked with a human rights worker, and I went to a meeting in Washington where I met with a human rights activist from a country in Central America that was documenting atrocities of death squads. And he was interviewing witnesses, building his case. Information is the enemy of human rights abusers. And he encrypts all these documents, all these interviews, all these lists of names of witnesses, all with PGP. If the government could get their hands on those lists of witnesses, they would go and kill them. So PGP is preventing that. I also got a letter from Latvia. This is the one I always hear. Every talk I've given, I've always read this letter aloud because it's so succinct and so to the point. I got this letter in electronic mail on the same day that Boris Yeltsin was shelling the parliament building in Moscow. It was last October. So this guy in Latvia said, "Phil, I wish you to know, let it never be, but if dictatorship takes over Russia, your PGP is widespread from Baltic to Far East now and will help democratic people if necessary. Thanks." It's the very best email I've ever gotten about PGP. It's the best mail of any kind. There have been obstacles to the spread of this technology. since it started. Mainly these obstacles are the export control laws and the patent laws, the fact that all of the patents for public key cryptography are held by a single company. Recently, there's been some improvements in the legal landscape around PGP. MIT has now published PGP with my cooperation, and everybody ought to get a copy from MIT now and use it. There's no reason to hide anymore. It's perfectly legitimate. There's no patent controversies associated with it, and MIT is publishing it on their internet site in such a way that is intended to preclude export. As I understand it, despite their best efforts of preventing export, somehow it has found its way to Europe. Certainly MIT had nothing to do with that, and absolutely, positively, I had nothing to do with that. It appears that no matter how much due diligence you show in preventing the export of free software, or I suppose even commercial software, it could happen to that too, there's no way to prevent the export of it. I guess maybe the only way to do it is to not publish it at all. Perhaps that's the only way to comply with the law, is that we can't publish things. I guess that kind of plays havoc with the First Amendment. Well, let's see. I guess I could throw it open for questions for a while, and then maybe respond to some of the questions with lengthier things. Most of the people I talk to don't have quite as much understanding of this technology as you folks, so a lot of the technical things I throw into a talk are probably moot for this audience. So let's take a question break, and maybe I'll get back. That'll inspire me to get back into things. Yeah. No, I have not heard about that. I'd like to hear more about who's using it over there. Yeah, you know, if everybody sent their mail on postcards, then if one person sent their mail in an envelope, it would draw attention to themselves and they would appear to be subversive. If we all use envelopes, nothing seems illegal about that. It doesn't draw attention. If all of our traffic were encrypted, there wouldn't be anyone drawing attention to themselves by using PGP. So if you send a letter to your mom, "Dear Mom, having a great time, wish you were here," it should be encrypted. Pardon me? That's true. Well, you know, she doesn't have PGP. We have to try to fix that, huh? Assuming she lives in the U.S., of course. You know, it's interesting that you draw that comparison about, or I'll draw this comparison about Yugoslavia. The people using cryptography in Yugoslavia can be persecuted. Yugoslavia is a war zone. There's a war going on in Yugoslavia. And yet, I see some similarities between the way the governments there react to people getting encrypted communications and the way they react here to people getting it. I think that we're being told by our own government here that there's something subversive about cryptography. Maybe I'm putting words in their mouth, I shouldn't do that, but it just seems to me that the government's reaction to cryptography here in a peacetime, benign environment like the United States is reacting in a way that is not completely unlike the way they react in a war situation. I think that we need to have a different attitude about cryptography here. This is not a war that we're in here. This is a peacetime economy. We're supposed to be able to enjoy our civil liberties. Yeah. Yeah, it has to be made easier. There's a lot of work underway right now to make PGP easier to use. PGP has been rewritten from the ground up and is nearing completion on a new version that would be more painless on a personal computer, a graphical user interface, seamless integration into mailers, a better Macintosh implementation. I guess that brings it a little closer. It's not completely invisible. We also need secure voice communications. It's possible to create software that would run on a personal computer, a multimedia PC with a Sound Blaster board or a Macintosh with sound capability, that would turn the personal computer into a secure telephone. Imagine a piece of software that could spread everywhere, except overseas, of course, that was free and could turn every multimedia PC into a secure telephone. What would that do to the state of privacy in our society? Yeah. Yes, that has occurred to me. The first step toward that would be to create some software that would turn a multimedia PC into a secure phone. And then hardware of the sort you described could be built that would be compatible with the same protocols. Yeah, well, it's going kind of slow because it's not funded. It's funny, you know. It's vaporware until you see it published. We're working on it. We have voice compression working. We've had that for months. It sounds pretty good. It sounds better than the old style linear predictive coding, LPC-10E. But it doesn't sound as good as the more recent high-powered voice compressors, code-excited linear prediction. It doesn't sound that good, but it does not require a digital signal processor to execute on. It can run on a 386, so it sounds somewhere in between, and it sounds like a bad phone line, actually. It sounds kind of raspy and crackly, but to be able to run that kind of voice compression on a 386 brings it down to almost every multimedia PC in the country. Not on the planet, but in the country. If we can get this out, I mean, I know for sure we're going to get it out. It's just that I don't have a time frame for it. It will make it possible to build other products on it that are compatible with it. It's funny, you know, somebody told me just a few weeks ago that I was talking to some friends of mine in the security industry who had been talking to somebody at AT&T, who was in charge of all their Clipper phone projects, and he said that just the mere knowledge that Bill Zimmerman was working on this project was enough to give AT&T a pessimistic outlook on its ability to sell Clipper phones. I told that to a friend of mine. He suggested that I put out a rumor that I was working on long-distance communication services. That's amazing. You know, the product doesn't even exist yet, and it's not funded, and it's just Garagetronics, and it can do that. Well, just based on my reputation, it's incredible. How come I'm not rich? You don't get rich by being a political activist. I've got to figure out a way. I've got to stop being a political activist. That's it. Yeah. Did you say 2.2? 2.3. Okay. Well, it is, actually. Yeah, okay. Let me explain that. This is a good opportunity to explain what's been going on. I think this is the first chance I've had to give a talk and explain what the intrigue in the process that led to the current situation. Oh, okay. The question was, what's going on with PGP 2.6? Why is it different than other versions? Why is there any incompatibility? Okay. Earlier versions of PGP had some controversial aspects regarding patents. PGP uses a public key encryption algorithm known as RSA. The RSA public key encryption algorithm has a patent on it, claimed by a company in California called Public Key Partners. It was the view of Public Key Partners that PGP infringed its patents. This caused a lot of tension between myself and Public Key Partners for quite a long time. They were trying to squash PGP everywhere, which only seemed to make it more popular, oddly enough. It was sort of the two live crew effect. I understand their record sales went through the roof when that judge, I think they convicted some record shopkeeper of obscenity for selling records from two live crew. And that sent their record sales through the roof. PGP's popularity, in part, was fueled by efforts to stop PGP. It's funny because I get mail now from people who think that if PGP has now become more legitimate than it was, then that makes it less attractive and they don't like using it. They'd rather use the old version. Usually it's people like the kind of people that come to a conference like this, you know. Young males full of testosterone and protest and rebellion. I'm sorry to report that PGP has become less controversial now. I think it's a great achievement that PGP has now become legitimized, so to speak. I don't think it was illegitimate before, but I mean, it's less legally controversial. What happened was, for years, Public Key Partners tried to stop PGP. They would write letters to universities carrying key servers. These are programs that run on the internet on university computers that will dispense public keys if requested. You can say, give me the key for John Smith, and it will give you the public key for John Smith. They would get threatening letters from Public Key Partners telling them they have to get rid of it. These threatening letters would also explain in gory detail how criminal PGP was, that it was criminally tainted. Criminal, everything criminal. The word criminal was mentioned many times. And so it would scare the university's legal departments, and they would take it down. And CompuServe got letters like this, too. So a lot of people were afraid to use PGP, or certainly institutions were afraid of touching it. Well, the RSA patent was originally developed, the algorithm was developed at MIT. And there's a lot of people at MIT that are unhappy with the way this patent has been managed. A lot of people at MIT feel that if the patent were being managed in an appropriate way, there would be RSA everywhere. I mean, look around you today. It's been 1978, I guess, since RSA was invented. How much public key cryptography do you see in your environment? Not much. What do you see is PGP. the technology has not spread. And a lot of people think the patent holders have not done enough to spread the technology. In fact, having all the patents in the hands of one company makes a convenient choke point for government control. So MIT decided, after talking with me, that they should do something about this. And so we entered into a lengthy process of figuring out how to break this logjam. And in May of this year, MIT published PGP 2.5 under a license for known as the RSA-REF license, which is a subroutine package that performs RSA calculations. The subroutine package is from the company that holds the patent, not Public Key Partners, but the sister company, RSA Data Security, Inc. This makes PGP non-controversial from a patent point of view. It means that everybody can use it without having to worry about getting lawyer letters from the patent holders. And this created quite a stir. It was not expected by everyone. MIT knew about it. I knew about it. Our lawyers knew about it. But no one else did, apparently. And I can't tell you what went on during the week that followed it, but people were going crazy on the net asking me for an explanation, and there was so much stuff going on I had to keep quiet about it. And so I didn't say anything on the net. This led to the widespread impression that MIT had somehow stolen PGP and that it was some kind of an evil plot. Nothing could be further from the truth. MIT publishing PGP 2.5 was a major accomplishment that it took months of negotiations. I think maybe about $20,000 of legal fees from MIT, MIT's lawyers, I mean. My own lawyers, which are mostly working pro bono, were involved. And we came out with this version. And in a very short time, we decided that in the interest of political stability with the patent holders, even though there was no legal obligation to do so, we would extend an olive branch in the hopes of getting peace in our time by issuing PGP 2.6, which would have slightly different properties. You see, it was the view of Public Key Partners that PGP infringed its, the older versions of PGP infringed its patents, and a newer version of PGP should be done in such a way as to discourage people from using the older version that, in the view of the patent holders, infringed their patents. And so I think actually that's not too much of a problem, because when people get new versions of PGP, they just naturally get the new version and stop using the old version. And if you just let sleeping dogs lie and let nature take its course, gradually people will stop using the old version that didn't have the RSA-REF license on it. And so I think that would have been the perfect solution, but Public Key Partners did not think that was a good solution. They wanted an immediate solution. So we made a format change in the data formats supported by PGP 2.6 so that it would accept both old and new formats, but it would start generating in September. It had a timer in it. The new format that would not be readable by the old PGP, the old infringing, as the in the view of the patent holders, infringing version of PGP. And so this would, as people switched over to the new version, there would, you know, there's no reason not to get the new version, because it uses both, it can read both formats, and it still generates the old formats now, and it will continue to generate the old formats until September. Then it would begin generating the new formats, at which time none of the old versions of PGP could read those new formats. Well, this is not significantly different than the kinds of changes that occur in the normal evolution of PGP or any other software product. If you try to open a new version of a spreadsheet from a new version of Microsoft Excel or Lotus 1-2-3, you have to use a version of the software that's contemporary with whatever version created that spreadsheet. You can't open a new spreadsheet with an old spreadsheet program. You can't use an ancient version of Microsoft Word to open a document created with a new version of Microsoft Word. At least I think that's true. That's true for most word processors, because new features are supported with new data formats. The same has been true of PGP since throughout PGP's history. The only difference is that this change in data format is sort of a legal upgrade instead of an engineering upgrade. And that kind of rubs people the wrong way. They feel like, well, there's no need to change this. There's no technical reason for doing it. Well, there's a political and legal reason. It was a way of trying to get the fighting to stop, relaxing the legal tensions. It doesn't degrade the security of PGP. PGP is still just as secure as it ever was, but it improves the legal situation. So I urge those of you who use PGP to switch over to the new version, and those of you who don't use it ought to get it and start using it, so that if everybody sends encrypted traffic all the time, then the few that really need it don't draw suspicions by encrypting their traffic. But if you all switch to the new version, then it will lead to a future where nobody can object to PGP on intellectual property grounds. The legal situation will be relaxed. And this would be good for me, too, because my own situation, I haven't talked about this yet. I guess I should talk about that. I'm under criminal investigation because of PGP. But before I get onto that, I'll answer a question. What was it? I am under criminal investigation still because of PGP. The question was a short version of the question is to talk about my own legal situation. That's not everything that you said, but I'll just take that as a quick rehash of the question. When PGP was published 3 years ago, it spread around the world. It was published domestically in the United States only. Just like publishing a book or a magazine or a newspaper, if you publish it in the United States, it's going to spread overseas because that's the nature of published works. That's the nature of First Amendment publication rights that we have. We have the right to publish things here, and they may spread overseas. I view PGP as something for solving our domestic privacy problems here. And so I intended it for use in the United States. However, it spread overseas. And in February of last year, 1993, I was visited by two U.S. customs agents from San Jose. I live in Boulder, Colorado, so they actually came out to visit me in Boulder. And they wanted to know about how PGP got out of the country. We had a meeting in my lawyer's office. My lawyer is Phil Dubois. By the way, Phil, could you stand up and wave? There may be a lot of potential clients for you out here. Since I know that there's a lot of hackers out here, and if any of you are having legal problems, you could do worse than talk to Phil here. We had a meeting in my lawyer's office, and they asked me a lot of questions about PGP. They wanted to know what it was and how it worked. They had recently talked to Jim Bidzos, who was the president of RSA Data Security and Public Key Partners, the holder of the patents of the RSA patents. They came away from the meeting with Bidzos with the following odd impressions. One, that PGP was stolen property. I tried to correct that impression by explaining that I wrote it from scratch completely without using anybody else's code. That this stolen property had crossed national borders, and so it came under the purview of U.S. Customs. It's kind of like if somebody stole a car in San Diego and drove it to Tijuana, then the U.S. Customs might be interested in that. Well, I tried to explain that PGP was not stolen property, that it was developed from scratch, that there was a patent controversy associated with it. This was a matter of civil law, civil lawsuits, and if the patent holders wanted to sue me civilly or challenge me in any way civilly, they could do so. And why would U.S. Customs be interested in that? They said they were also interested in the export control issues, that the State Department has a munitions list of items that cannot be exported without a license. As the name implies, the munitions list is comprised mainly of weaponry, But on this list is encryption software. And so you can't export encryption software without a license from the State Department. So how did PGP get exported? I said, I don't know, which is true. I actually don't know how it got exported. Anyway, that's what they came to talk to me about. They told me at the time that I was not a target of the investigation, and indeed there was no target of the investigation in February of 93. But at some time later on, in September of 93, after, what happened was, I made a deal with Viacrypt, a company in Phoenix, Arizona, to sell PGP commercially. At the time, I was being urged by a lot of cryptography activists, the cypherpunks, the founders of the cypherpunks, Tim May, Eric Hughes. They were urging me to do something, to do anything, to get PGP in a legal situation where it could be used in private industry without fear of patent infringement lawsuit. And so I was trying to figure out how to do that. I sure as heck couldn't get a license from Public Key Partners since they didn't like me one bit. A company with a license appeared on the scene and called me up and said, look, we've got a license from Public Key Partners to sell any product we want to sell that uses the RSA encryption algorithm. Wouldn't it be nice if we sold PGP? I thought that was an exceptionally clever idea. You mean you don't have to get a license and tell them what you want to use the license for? No, they said, we already have this license. We can now sell anything. So they sold PGP. And when that happened, within a week of me announcing that deal, within a week, prior to that announcement, I was told by the customs agents that there was nothing going on in the investigation, that it was back burner, that it was not a priority thing for them. But within a week of announcing that deal, it had escalated to the level of a federal grand jury and a federal prosecutor. And subpoenas were being issued. Subpoenas were issued to Viacrypt and to another company. My lawyer called the prosecutor and asked him if I was a target of the investigation, and he said yes. And so that's when we knew that somehow between February and September I had become a target of the investigation. And it certainly had escalated in importance. I have a feeling that the escalation occurred as a result of that deal. Since that time, the investigation has gone on. There's been investigative activity. We know of other things that have happened in the investigation. We don't like to say exactly what, because we, just like the investigator plays his cards close to his chest, we also like to play our cards close to our chest. But the legal bills still add up. I do have a legal defense fund, and it's run by Phil Dubois here. If any of you want to contribute to it, that'd be nice. I'm still unindicted, but I won't know how that turns out until it plays itself out. Last I heard, they're going to be looking at the question of whether to seek indictment sometime in September. There is a prison sentence associated with this area of law, the area of law that they're telling us they're investigating me for, and that is 41 months to 51 months in a federal prison. These are the federal mandatory sentencing guidelines. Judges are not allowed to deviate from those guidelines. Mandatory and guidelines, an odd combination of words. So it's a pretty serious situation to be under criminal investigation and facing a prison sentence if convicted. It's hard to believe that could come about from writing software for civil liberties. But that's the seriousness with which the government views this. The export control laws are still being fought in Congress. The House Intelligence Committee killed the Cantwell bill. My own congressman from my own district in Washington sits on that committee. It was a unanimous 13-0 vote to kill it. It may be reintroduced on the floor. couple of days ago, Al Gore wrote a letter to Maria Cantwell saying that he was changing some kind of policy regarding Clipper. This creates an illusion of change, but if you look at read the fine print carefully, it really doesn't change much of anything. It's still a key escrow system. We have a lot of political work to do if we want to try to preserve our civil liberties in the information age. A lot of people feel that they can't stop the government from doing what they want to do. There was a time not so long ago when the world stood on the brink of nuclear war during the mid-1980s, and we were at the height of the Cold War then. Somehow, the world has changed. Peace activists worked hard on it, and somehow the world changed. It is possible to make progress against seemingly hopeless objectives, or for seemingly hopeless objectives. There was a time when other seemingly unchangeable policies existed. Slavery was a thoroughly entrenched way of life, and somehow it was changed in the last century. The divine right of kings. Kings could just arbitrarily kill anybody they wanted to kill and do anything they wanted to do, and today we have more democracies than kingdoms. The nuclear arms race has ended. There's things that there are institutions that involved vested interests that seemed impossible to shake loose, and yet somehow we've managed to improve the world and shake loose those vested interests and end those bad institutions. Today, we have the apparatus of the Cold War still hanging on and trying to run our lives and invade our privacy. It's up to us to try to change that, and I think that we've faced more hopeless battles in the past and we've overcome them. If we work very hard now, we can ensure our privacy into the information age. We can get the export controls lifted, we can get the government to change its crypto policy. Such an obscure thing that most of the average members of the public don't understand is significant for our civil liberties. It's up to us to educate the general public and explain to them why government policy on crypto export can affect our civil liberties. If we persevere and we don't relax, I think we can get these laws changed, and we can get the privacy we want in the information age. So, let's get to it. Thanks.
I've got a bunch of people that come in and you've taken over.
Yeah.
Good job. Thanks. Okay.